The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, February 10th, 1946, we present the 13th in the distinguished new NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
the war against inflation. Now, in the 6 months of the first year of peace, we, the American people, face a crisis. This is a year of decision. We now stand at a junction from which lead several roads. The high road of economic stability, full production, and real prosperity, or
the road that can lead to a false boom and inflated prosperity, and then depression.
These are the decisions we face as we push forward in
the war against inflation.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. This has certainly been a wild week down here. I haven't seen anything quite like it since the days of NRA. Meetings at all hours of the day and night, and excited conferences in the White House. Wages and prices are the words most commonly heard. Bowles and Snyder are the names most often mentioned. Later in this program, I shall bring you a summary of what has happened this week. So in Washington, we are standing by.
And in New York, this is Robert St. John. With me here are Mr. Harold Fleming, business correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and Mr. Gordon Creighton, assistant general manager of the National Retail Dry Goods Association. And from Toledo, we will hear Mr. Walter Reuther, international vice president of the United Automobile Workers Union, CIO. With their help, we will document the developments which brought us to this week of decision.
Hey, Shops. Shops, I got it. I got it.
Yeah, Joe, what?
An idea for a song with significance, with boom, right up to the minute. We'll clean up.
Yeah, with a broom and shovel.
No, Shopsy boy, this is it.
Sure, sure, so is the last one. And so, my darling, before next winter's snow, you and I'll be together in the UNO.
Forget what happened last week. Look, last night I was reading a paper.
Yeah, I know, the racing form.
No, no, not the racing form. I read this article, and it come to me like a revulsion from heaven.
This I can believe.
Everybody, the man said in the article, was worrying about inflation, about the strikes and high prices and so, etc. And that's when it hit me. Listen, here's the pitch. A guy's in love with a girl, see?
Right off, you got a new twist.
No, 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 here's where it comes. The guy says to the chick, look, baby, the way I feel for you, I'd buy you a car, a gross of nylons, whatever you want, if your heart won't pull a strike on me. And she says, now get this, she says, no, there's a great shortage. And if you start throwing the lettuce around, you'll make inflation in the nation. So all I want is love, baby, until those inflation blues roll by. Well, how's that for a switcheroo?
Oh, great. And I got just a tune to go with it. Inflation. Stay away from my door.
And while the assorted geniuses of Tin Pan Alley were wrestling to tuck a major economic problem into a 32-bar straitjacket, a letter came to me in care of the National Hour. The letter was from a gentleman in Massachusetts, Peter J. Guare. Mr. Guare wrote in part,
I heard you say next week's show would be about inflation. I'll be in New York, and I'd like to come to the studio. And I would consider it a great favor if someplace in the program you'd explain so I could understand just what they mean by inflation, if this is not asking too much, Mr. St. John.
And so for the first item on our agenda, we answer Mr. Guare's question. We've consulted some authorities for their views and definitions. First, a professor of economics.
Inflation is a disproportionate and relatively sharp and sudden increase in the quantity of money or credit or both, relative to the amount of exchange business, and always produces a rise in the price level.
Did you follow that, Mr. Guare?
Well, would the professor mind repeating that?
Why, certainly, sir. Inflation is a disproportionate...
Excuse me, Professor, but one of our research men has just come in with a definition from a part-time economist. He put it this way.
Inflation, Bud? Well, that's where there's plenty of money in people's pockets and in banks. But the stuff that money can buy is scarce, so prices go up. So, it's the old story of supply and demand. See?
Professor, would you say that that definition was sound?
Well, it's phrased somewhat unusually, but it's basically sound. By the way, what does that part-time economist do for a living?
He tends bar over on 3rd Avenue. On September 2nd, 1945, this nation came out of a terrible war with too much money and a great roar of need.
A car. I need a new car.
An electric washing machine.
A house. I gotta build a house.
An electric ring.
I need a couple of suits. A dozen shirts.
A radio phonograph.
I need a new car.
This is McCormick in Washington again. The years of war put more and more money into America's pockets. The years of war created more and more shortages of civilian goods. Demand was greater than supply. And finally, prices gave way. They went up. Since September of 1939, the cost of living has gone up 33%. But in a similar seven-year period in World War I, the cost of living rose 108%. The rise in our present cost of living would have gone higher than the 33% if the Office of Price Administration had not taken hold in May of 1942. 90% of the increase came before that date.
Yes, it stopped here, all right, but runaway inflation was on the loose all over the world.
In China, 700 Chinese dollar for one U.S. dollar. Even though the official rate of exchange is 20 to 1.
On the black market, the Italians offer 400 lira for $1. Before the war, the exchange was 20 to $1.
In Greece, 400 billion drachmas for one of our dollars. In normal times, a dollar is worth 125 drachmas.
That sounds bad, Mr. St. John. Could that happen here?
Well, Mr. Guare, let's ask Mr. Harold Fleming, business correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. What do you think, Mr. Fleming? Could it happen here?
In my opinion, no. Chiefly because the American people want steady living costs. So the Congress has given the government a great many powers under the various price control acts. And modern history shows that strong governments like that of the United States and Great Britain are able to maintain fairly steady prices regardless of various pressures.
Well, that's very hopeful, Mr. Fleming, but the spiral of inflation has begun to move again upward. What's your reaction to that?
I see the present inflation as a necessary but not too dangerous phase of a great economic experiment. That experiment is to find out how far wages can be raised, prices held steady, and the wheels of industry kept turning all at the same time. Last August, the government announced that wages could be raised, but prices should be held down. But now it seems to have turned out that wages cannot be raised all along the line to everybody without some increase in prices. In other words, the original policy was too limited. Now we are making some changes. And we will keep on making changes until we find out how to achieve our three-way goal: full production at high wages and with steady prices.
In the first few months after the war, this great new experiment in applied economics began undergoing a most devastating test. There was four times as much money in circulation as in the boom years before 1929. The demand for civilian goods was greater than ever, and it kept growing. Supply was small, and it grew smaller. The growing pressure of demand against supply began to move the spiral of inflation on upward. The cost of living had risen 33%. Now, wages began to climb to try to catch up with prices.
The United Automobile Workers, CIO, ask as a cost of living adjustment a wage raise of 30%. General Motors offers a settlement at a lower figure, and the plants are shut down by a strike.
Ford signs for 15 1/10% increase. Chrysler for 16 7/10%. The Kaiser Fraser Company signs on the union's terms.
RCA announces a wage increase. Clothing manufacturers grant an increase.
Wages were climbing upward to meet the cost of living. The spiral began moving and prices began to push hard against the ceiling.
January 31st. The lumber industry flatly asserted today that OPA must lift price ceilings if the acute shortage is to be ended.
Meat packers demand an advance.
Sugar to be raised.
Cheese prices will move upward.
With no ceiling set, cotton has risen to its highest price in 25 years.
The tug of war between wages and prices is on. With us today on the National Hour is a man from each side of the rope. Each man represents an important view in the controversy. First, from our studios in New York, Mr. Gordon Creighton, Assistant General Manager of the National Retail Dry Goods Association. Mr. Creighton.
In this moment of controversy over the extension of price control, the National Retail Dry Goods Association takes a position based squarely upon its belief that production is the only cure for inflation. The moderate course we are pursuing is the result of the long history of our almost 6,000 member stores and our experience as an association through two wars and many booms and depressions. In our annual convention last month, one of the largest on record, the delegates voted unanimously that our policy should be that we do not seek to end price control. We seek to amend it so as to increase production. In our opinion, OPA has it in its power to stimulate the flow of essential goods immediately by stepping up two of its policies. These are incentive pricing, or the granting of sufficient increases to manufacturers to make it possible for them to expand operations on needed but missing merchandise, and extension of decontrol actions into the fields where shortages are sharpest. OPA recently applied the incentive pricing corrective to the making of linings for men's suits, which had been hanging, unfinished, and useless in the factories. Let there be more of this type of thing. We retailers are the purchasing agents for our consumers. We are the ones who have to face the ultimate consumer across the last 3 feet of selling space in the economic process, our counters. We are tired of confronting them with empty shelves, which had to stand idle during the war, but need no longer do so. And millions of veterans are now civilians again. Take controls off shirts. That will be something for the boys that they really need. And it would be a step that OPA could easily retrace if inflationary prices resulted. In fact, it would afford the most conservative kind of a test, since nothing else in the economy would be affected. That is our stand in this moment of controversy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Creighton. And now for an opposing view, a man who is a frequent visitor to the Capitol, the Vice President of the UAW, Mr. Walter Reuther, speaking to us from NBC's affiliate, WSPD, in Toledo.
Inflation today comes from the pressure campaign of big business for unjustified price increases. Wage increases are no longer the major issue in the dispute which is holding up our progress towards the goals of full employment, full production, and full consumption. The major issue now is prices. From the beginning of the GM controversy, the General Motors workers and their union have conducted an all-out fight against price increases. The union has consistently stated that we did not want a wage increase that would necessitate one red cent in higher prices. The recommendations of the President's fact-finding board supported our contention that General Motors could grant the wage increase without a price increase. Despite this fact, the General Motors Corporation continues to defy the President's recommendation. General Motors, the steel industry, and other large corporations are hell-bent on destroying price control. They are determined to squeeze out of the American consumers unnecessary and unjustified price increases. American labor does not want a 10-cent wage increase in one pocket with a 15-cent price increase taken out of the other pocket. We do not want to be paid off in the wooden nickels of inflation. We want, and we are fighting for, an increase in real wages, an increase in purchasing power. We want wages that will buy more food, more clothes, better housing, and more of the good things of life that we need for ourselves, our wives, and our children. The picket lines of the General Motors workers are the front-line defenses against industry's attempt to wreck price control. We are determined that the government and the American people shall not be hijacked into permitting higher prices that would provide industry with the most outrageous profits in history. We call upon President Truman to stand firm against price increases and to mobilize the support of the people who in overwhelming majority favor rigid price control. That is the way to defeat inflation. That is the way it must be defeated.
National Hour returns you to New York.
Up to this point in our program, we have made much mention of prices, wages, ceilings, the dangers of runaway inflation. But now, to tie the threads together, let us consider the case of one industry. Let's consider steel. 3 weeks ago, on a cold midnight of winter, 750,000 members of the United Steelworkers of America went out on strike. If the strike lasted 1 month, 2 million men and women in other industries would be laid off. The country would begin to drop $500 million in lost business each week.
The conferences begun between the Steel Union and the Steel Institute before the strike were continued at the White House. Both sides came to the president with their demands. The union spoke...
A wage rise of $2 a day.
The Steel Institute replied...
An adequate raise in the price of steel before any consideration of a wage settlement.
Well, they met with the president, who in his latest message said most industries and most companies have adequate leeway to grant substantial wage increases. So the nation waited for the verdict from the White House, and then the news was released. The president had scaled down the union's demand to 18.5 cents an hour and had indicated that steel would be allowed a price rise. After the conference, reporters asked the steel workers' representatives if the union would accept the president's proposed settlement.
The union accepts.
And then the representative of the steel manufacturers was asked the same question.
Even with an increase in the price of steel, the highest wage that can be offered is 15 cents an hour.
The steel workers' union submitted a statement to the administration which in substance maintained...
The savings which the steel companies will make through elimination of overtime, through downgrading, through the elimination of the excess profits tax, would be enough to cover a 43 cents an hour wage raise.
In reply, a spokesman for the steel companies said,
Our figures show that we are already entitled by law to price increases by reason of past heavy increases in our costs, quite apart from any present wage increase.
When questioned about just how much of an increase in the present price of steel would be needed to cover the 18.5 cent raise, the answer came,
An increase greatly in excess of $6.25 a ton.
It became clear then down in Washington that any settlement of the steel dispute would be based on an increase in both wages and prices. Behind this recommendation from Washington lay a bitter struggle which has been carried on between two groups of presidential advisors ever since the end of the war. One group has centered around the director of reconversion, John W. Snyder. Mr. Snyder has held the view that...
Price control must be maintained. There is no question about that. But the price control policy must be flexible enough to allow for adjustments where necessary in order to stimulate production. The present inflexible policy of OPA is stifling production.
And heading the opposite camp has been the chief of OPA, Chester Bowles, who has maintained...
The policy of OPA does permit the lifting of ceiling prices, but only when supplies are equal to demand or when an industry can prove hardship. Prices may also be lifted when a particular item is judged to have little effect on the cost of living. If history teaches anything, it proves that inflationary pressures created by the war do not end when the war ends.
For 5 months, this conflict continued not only within the administration, but throughout the country. Meanwhile, the president's indication that a price rise for steel was forthcoming set Wall Street tickers humming with renewed energy. Speculation hopped on the gravy train as stocks began to rise.
Oh, hiya, baby. Boy, oh, boy, I feel great. Just great.
What happened to you, Henry?
Wall Street made me a neat 10 grand today. The market soaring up like a great big beautiful bird.
With all the strikes on.
Oh, honey, you're a beautiful wife. But listen, the president said maybe steel could have a raise in price, right?
Yes, dear, but it hasn't come through yet.
Ah, but it will, darling, it will. And that means steel is going to crack a big enough hole in the OPA ceiling so everything will ride on up with steel.
But, Henry, remember what happened in 29.
Yeah, but not this time, baby. We'll play it smart this time.
But if the price ceilings suddenly go up and there's still not enough production, won't that be dangerous?
That's just the point they made at the convention. Now, prices must go up before we can really get into production. No up in prices, no production. Why, they say that even the chief of reconversion in Washington is for giving steel $4 a ton. Only that OPA guy keeps holding on to his ceilings.
Another cocktail, Henry.
Okay, baby, then we'll go out and celebrate. OPA ceilings are cracking up, cracking up, cracking up. OPA ceilings are cracking up. My fair jester.
While the deadlock continued in steel, the country was able to study as if in a scientific laboratory the winds and currents and pressures of inflation. On January 30th, Henry Ford II, president of the Ford Motor Company, sent an urgent telegram to Washington.
Unless steel can be made available to us and to our suppliers promptly, we'll have to shut down completely this week. It costs $400,000 a day to maintain idle assembly lines. At current OPA ceilings, we're losing $300 on every car we make.
A
Out of the steel deadlock came another pressure to force prices upward. Members of the Tri-State Industrial Association found themselves squeezed in a vice between fixed ceilings for the goods they produce and rising wages and prices they will have to pay.
The Tri-State Industrial Association is composed of 56 steel fabricators and processors. We manufacture thousands of products from paper clips to rolling mill machinery. Whatever price raise steel will have to pay, we will have to pay. Whatever price increase is allowed, we will have to pay that much more for our raw steel.
Then what is the alternative?
Unless the government allows us to raise prices, some factories may have to shut down permanently and throw many thousands of employees out of work.
The pressure against price ceilings comes from more and more sides, and the total pressure grows greater and greater.
Mr. St. John.
Yes, Mr. Greer.
Manufacturers and businessmen are consumers, too. Do they want to take off all price ceilings?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing the way people think on this question of ceilings.
I say price controls on food and rent, well, that's fine. But lift the ceilings in our business and we'll soon be able to supply the people of America.
And what business are you in, sir?
I manufacture auto parts.
We need ceilings on clothing and food, but ceilings choke the life out of guys like me.
Like you, sir?
Yes, I own a couple of apartment houses.
And I say that wages in our industry must be raised.
What do you do, sir?
I'm a union representative.
For 4 years, we were the goats for ceilings. It's time we had some relief. But the ceilings ought to be held on steel and automobiles.
Hmm. And your business?
Men's clothing manufacturer.
Oh, say, before you go, sir.
Yes, what is it?
Do you know where I can buy a white shirt, please?
No place, brother, till the ceiling price is lifted.
Now, in the 6 months of peace, the spiral of inflation is pushing hard, pushing upward. Last week, the issue of wages and prices came to sharp focus. The situation in steel was to be finally settled. The country waited, for as steel went, so would go the nation.
Well, here in Washington, the week began calmly enough. The administration on Tuesday began formulating a new wage price policy. And the newsmen in Washington stood by for a definite statement. Conferences went on in the White House all day. And 48 hours later, a wage and price formula was apparently settled upon.
The new formula, it's reported, will not mean higher prices all around, though it will lift certain prices to a new plateau.
Then everyone's attention shifted to the reports of the behind-the-scenes differences between Mr. Bowles and Mr. Snyder on the basic policy to be followed.
It is reported that Mr. Bowles is opposed to any agency bypassing OPA to make price settlements, as in steel.
Mr. Snyder, on the other hand, would like the Office of Reconversion to retain a measure of overall control over the wage-price situation.
On Thursday, it became apparent that the formula had not been settled upon, but was still in the works. Then the whole week of meetings, of statements, of conjecture drew to its close, and at the end of it, the president canceled his vacation trip in order to deal personally with problems the White House said require his personal attention. But a formula definitely should be coming this week. Right now, it seems fairly certain Mr. Bowles and his policies will win out with some modifications. But leaving this critical debate for a moment, the National Hour asked Mr. Bowles to give us his views on the inflation problem. And Mr. Bowles gave us this statement. More important than recognizing the dangers of inflation, Mr. Bowles said, is the way we face them. I personally have a great deal of confidence that we shall meet these dangers in a spirit of courage and with a firm conviction that they can and must be overcome. Inflation has been licked thus far. Inflation is being licked today. Unless we are utterly lacking in courage and good judgment, we can continue to lick inflation. We can keep this economy on an even keel, Mr. Bowles continues, until there are so many goods of all kinds that controls can be safely removed. And we know then that this economy can henceforward take care of itself. The choice is up to us, Mr. Bowles concludes. We can blunder into disaster once more, as we did after the last war, or we can take steps now to ensure a stable, sound prosperity, with factories going full blast and jobs, good-paying jobs for all. And that is Mr. Bowles' statement today to the National Hour.
Inflation has been the subject of our documentary, and this is what we have learned.
That a condition of inflation does exist in these United States today. Most crucial is the matter of rising wages and rising prices.
Then another factor in inflation is the scarcity of consumer goods. To get factories into production, to get workers back on the job, to determine a workable balance between wages and prices, that is the task with which the government, industry, and labor grappled this last week. And the government's formula is soon to be announced. To keep inflation under control, to move from war to a solid prosperity of peace, that is the goal, not only of the various factions involved, but of the people themselves.
On the subject of the war against inflation, then, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen to the National Hour again next Sunday, the anniversary of Iwo Jima, when our subject will be the United States Marines.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 13th of the new series on current affairs and national problems. Our speakers today were Gordon Creighton, Walter Reuther, and Harold Fleming. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington.